All right, sorry for the delay, folks. Thanks for joining us, or thanks for joining me, I should say. Nick Fillingham, I'm a technical evangelist and producer in the Channel 9 team at Microsoft. This session is behind the scenes of Channel 9 Live at Mix 11. If you're here for this session, I assume you're either A, curious as to how we put on the Channel 9 Live show that was in the foyer for days 1 and 2, Tuesday and Wednesday. And I'm also hoping that you're also interested in perhaps trying to maybe borrow from some of the techniques and the processes that we have kind of established and stumbled upon along the way to implement in maybe some of your own live streaming projects. What I'll walk through is basically how we go about putting on the Channel 9 Live show, decisions that we made that were specific to our audience, specific to our needs and our requirements. They may not fit for your needs and requirements, but hopefully I'll try and walk through the decision process for you so you can kind of get a little bit of context, and that may help for your own implementations. So another reason why this session is happening, and also why it's happening on Thursday, is I'm at the tail end of the media track. So you have probably already learned about Silverlight Media Framework, IAS Media Services 4, Audience Insight, the MMP Video Editor. Did I get that right, Alex? I did, which was called Rough Cut Editor and Expression Encoder 4. One of the things that DPE does, Channel 9 is part of DPE, is that we like to dog food our own software. If you're not familiar with that term, it basically means we like to try and use as many of our tools and products and services before we put them in front of our customers. Channel 9 Live is really an opportunity for us to dog food as much of our own technology and put it out there in front of the public, put it in front of people in you know, really interesting ways at scale, and in high-risk environments like the foyer of Mix 11 to see how it works. So Channel 9 Live is in part kind of a dog food project as well as a way for us to really kind of deliver on what Channel 9 is. So starting there, what is Channel 9? So if you haven't been to the Channel 9 website before, it's channel9.msdn.com. We are a community site that was originally created for developers, Microsoft developers. We've expanded that somewhat now to technical enthusiasts and hobbyists, basically anyone interested in technology. We are a Microsoft property run by the DPE group, and we basically scour the company for interesting people, interesting stories. We take our video cameras with us, and we record video content that we publish on the Channel 9 website for our community to consume. That can be incredibly deep topics, like Mads Torgensen talking about async CTP, or it could be more lighthearted or consumer-orientated content to do with Windows Phone 7 and apps, and we even do some fun stuff around Halloween and Valentine's Day just to kind of go crazy. Channel 9 is about 7 years old. In fact, we were 7 years old 2 weeks ago, and it's a very popular site. It's one of the most popular video portals or video sites that Microsoft owns. It may even be the most popular. I was looking this morning when I took this screenshot, and there were 132,000 users online at that time. So we're talking about a relatively large community. It's global. We have people hitting our forums and hitting our servers 24 hours a day from all corners of the globe. And it's a wonderful, vibrant place to go if you are technical and interested in technology, and especially technology from Microsoft. The name of Channel 9, just very quickly, if you fly on a United Airlines or Alaska Airlines flight and you plug your little free headset into the little hole, I shouldn't do that motion, that hole in the seat headrest thing, assuming it's not filled with chewing gum, and you listen to Channel 9, what you're listening to is the pilots flying the plane. And that's really the analogy behind Channel 9. You are listening to the pilots flying the plane, communicating with ground control, and it's basically the way that we like to think about Channel 9. We're enabling you to listen to the pilots being the people at Microsoft making decisions, flying the plane obviously being Microsoft. So what is Channel 9 Live? Channel 9 Live is that same ethos of listening on the pilot, but the whole idea is that we now want to make it a two-way immersive conversation. So Channel 9, we go and ask questions to people at Microsoft on your behalf. Channel 9 Live, we create an experience where you can actually ask your questions directly to the pilots, directly to the interesting people here at the Mix conference, whether they're Scott Hanselman, whether they're Miguel Diacaza, whether they're Channel 9 people like Dan Fernandez. We give you the opportunity to actually speak to these people directly. And obviously that's what I'm going to be covering in this presentation. Some things that we like to say about Channel 9, like we like to say that we are unscripted, which is true. We have no scripts. We start broadcasting at 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. We go through till 5 p.m., which is 6 hours back to back. We have no scripts. We have a schedule. We have some very broad topics that we like to cover as part of our content, but it is essentially an unscripted conversation. I'll get to that a little bit later on. And we are completely interactive. The reason that we are unscripted is that we rely 100% on our audience, our live streaming audience, to be interacting with us, primarily via Twitter, to send in questions and comments, which we then use as part of the conversation with our guests that are on stage. So it's really a conversation between our anchor, in this screenshot here, that's Dan on the far right, our guests, Scott Hanselman and Miguel Diacaza, and then you, the audience, watching live at home and then sending in your questions. Some other quick points about Channel 9 Live. We are striving to kind of hit the industry benchmark in terms of quality. So this is a Silverlight smooth streaming experience. We're a 6-profile, 720p high-definition broadcast. So if you can get at least 3.5 or 4 megabit per second broadband on the client side, you will get our full 720p high-definition stream, and it looks gorgeous. And obviously, if you don't have that much bandwidth, the player will bounce you down to various profiles to give you the best possible experience. All right, so why live? And this is really the first question that we asked ourselves, and I think a question that you guys should ask yourselves if you are thinking about doing live streaming. Why would you do a live broadcast to the web? My opinion is there's two reasons. You do a live broadcast to the web because you have information that is newsworthy or timely, something that is a big announcement. Perhaps you're announcing a new product. You're announcing something that is going to hit the front page of ZDNet or the tech blogs across the world. You have a newsworthy announcement. That's kind of one scenario. The second scenario is that you want to enable this participatory, interactive element with your audience. You want to give the people that are interested in you and interested in your company and your message and your news the opportunity to talk back to you in real time. The way that Channel 9 used to come to conferences like Mix and PDC is we would bring a camera crew. We'd bring maybe one or two guys with cameras. We'd bring some hosts that would be from the Channel 9 team that have microphones. We'd run around the show floor. We'd film interesting interviews, panels, demos. Then we'd take that footage, jump on a plane, head back to Redmond, we'd edit it, we'd publish it on the Channel 9 site. That could sometimes take up to a week or 2 weeks. We improved on that by bringing editors on site, so we could kind of get that turnaround down to maybe 2 or 3 days, sometimes 24 hours if we were really good. But the end result was we still had this kind of one-way conversation. We weren't really truly engaging our audience who, you know, for people who are really interested in the announcements of Mix or PDC, for example, it's immediate. They're on Twitter, they're on their blogs, they're on Facebook. They want to know what's happening. They want to be a part of the conversation. So for us, although the news timely angle is probably not as strong for the content on Channel 9 Live, it's the interactive element, it's the community participation that was the reason why we decided to go live and not just record this to disk and publish at a later date. We also immediately follow the keynote. So the keynotes here at Mix ran from 9 a.m. to 11 a.m. on Tuesday and Wednesday. Channel 9 Live began the frame, not even the second, the frame that the keynotes finished, the Channel 9 Live broadcast began. And we did that for a few reasons. One, we spend a lot of money on the keynotes. They're a very expensive production to actually physically produce, and obviously they're the flagship element of the conference here at Mix. And so there's a lot of investment made in those keynotes. We see Channel 9 Live as a way to extend that and a way to take advantage of the investment that we put in, not only the production, but the announcements and the interest from our community and from the media. So part of it is really leveraging the overall investment that we've made in the event. And the other part of it is that we have an audience. We have people that are tuning in and are watching these keynotes, and they're really interested to find out what we've announced, what we're talking about, and there's only so much you can cover in 2 hours. So the Channel 9 Live broadcast that follows the keynote, which runs for anywhere between 6 and 7 hours, is really an opportunity for us to extend on those messages and extend on those announcements from the keynote. So where does Channel 9 Live sit in terms of other live streaming content on the web? This is a very simplistic overview, but I was asked last night to kind of provide this a little bit of scale. So on the very far left, you've got something like Ustream. Anyone can plug their webcam or their laptop with a webcam in it, connect to Ustream, and just start broadcasting. And that's really a one-to-few scenario. Some of the most popular Ustream feeds are probably in the hundreds or thousands. That's probably at the very, very top of the Ustream tier. But then once you're thinking about, you know, trying to hit 10,000 people, 20,000 people, 50,000 people, Ustream really isn't probably the right solution for you. On the other end of the scale, you have the Olympics. And Alex in the front, who's going to be heckling me for the next hour, and his team who built out the smooth streaming player and all of the infrastructure behind the Olympic streaming, that's in the 500,000 plus live streaming viewers. So that's kind of on the far end of the scale. Channel 9 Live is somewhere in the middle. And the reason why I've got kind of that little blue cloud is because we can really scale anywhere from one user for a very specific scenario if we chose to do that. We can scale probably up to the hundreds of thousands. And it's really up to us to identify in advance how many people are we trying to target. And then that allows us to scale up or scale down the production that we do. So Channel 9 Live is kind of somewhere between Ustream and a PDC or a mixed keynote, which is obviously a big scale, but kind of wanted to provide that. So this is about as technical as the presentation is going to get. So if you're looking for code, if you're looking for really hardcore technical stuff, it's not going to get much more complex than this. But this is kind of the 40,000 foot view of our technical overflow. So there's two physical locations here. The first big block box on the left is the Mandalay Bay. The green box there is the Channel 9 live set, which I hope you've all seen out in the foyer. We are producing content at the Channel 9 live set, and we're pushing out our signal to two separate paths. We have a primary path, which is a 720p HD SDI signal that is going out over Vivix, to iStream Planet, that is our encoding partner, who just happened to be based here in Las Vegas. And then we have a secondary path where we encode a failover redundant signal on site, which we push out to iStream Planet over IP. When I started learning about live streaming technologies and putting together Channel 9 Live, I learned about this thing called Vivix. And this is like the coolest thing ever. Vivix is a private dark fiber network, which you can patch into for about $500 an hour or something. I can't remember the price, but essentially all of the major sports venues and music venues around North America, and I think it goes up into Canada as well, have these Vivix, and there's Hibernia and other companies, but they're these private dark fiber patches, and you can kind of turn them on and off as you need to in order to get this. You can get HD SDI transport from here in the Mandalay Bay to perhaps back in Redmond, where we have a Vivix drop at MS Studios, to to iStream Planet in Las Vegas. But the cool thing is, you can rent this dark fiber by the hour, and it allows you to send an HD SDI signal, you know, hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of miles, for what is relatively low cost. So when we discovered Vivix and Hibernia, it was I thought it was very, very cool that you could go and kind of rent this stuff by the hour. So we're utilizing Vivix in order to get our signal here in the Mandalay Bay over to iStream Planet. iStream Planet take that signal off of Vivix, and they plug it into their banks of encoders. Now, I've got one of the encoders here. This is an inlet smooth streaming encoder. This one's about 2 years old. It's a Spinnaker 7000, which allows us to do four profiles in parallel. The top profile is a 720p HD profile, and that steps down to, well, we can actually choose any profile we like, but this one will do high definition live smooth streaming. We have one, that's it, you're looking at it, and that's the one that we use for our on-site redundant encoding. iStream Planet have about 1,000 of them, or, you know, they have many, 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 and that's what we use for our primary. So once the signal gets to iStream Planet, they're creating six smooth streaming profiles for us, and they're pushing them through to Origin, which they host. Origin is basically just a Windows Server 2008 box running IIS Media Services 4. Our on-site encoder is also pointing to the same Origin. We have a timecode generator on site to make sure that it syncs up with iStream Planet. We only have the one encoder, so we're only pushing out four profiles, but because we have the timecode generator, they are in sync. And if for some reason we did need to fail over to the on-site encoder, you probably wouldn't notice as the end user. There might be a very slight delay, maybe a few black frames, but essentially it would be a kind of a seamless transition. From there, Origin is pointing out to two CDNs. We have a primary CDN and a secondary CDN. When we have large-scale events like Mix or the PDC and we need redundancy, we push out to more than one CDN solution. For Mix, we're using Azure as our primary CDN, and we're using Akamai as secondary. And the way that works is that the lighting tower falls over, iStream Planet actually set up two paths. So they're sending manifests out to Azure as primary, and then they're also running Akamai in parallel, kind of in silent parallel. And then if for some reason we do need to make the switch from Azure to Akamai or back again, iStream Planet then just go into the player and they enable or disable a manifest. And then on the very end there you see is the player experience, and that's our player is based on player framework or Smurf framework 2.4. What's really interesting is that this entire process from when a frame is generated on the Channel 9 live set on the far left to when you see it live on your player is anywhere from 15 seconds to about 30. So there is a very slight delay, but it is pretty much instantaneous. And when you're using Twitter as your method of communicating and feeding back from your audience, 30 seconds really isn't much. It's as instantaneous as you can get for live smooth streaming. Moving right along. Oh, and here are our profiles if you're interested. I'll make the deck available to download from the Mix website, so you don't have to kind of jot these down here. Alex actually built these profiles. Are these yours, Alex? I think they are. I think Alex built these profiles. So as you can see, the top profile there is 1280 by 720, and it's at just under 3 megabits per second. There are six profiles stepping down all the way to 350K. Audio is on a separate stream, and when you aggregate them together, it's just over 8 megs. We have actually, instead of using Vivix in the past, we've actually used IP as our transport method over to Origin, which our iStream Planet usually hosts for us. They're kind of our major live streaming partner. If you want to use IP as your transport method, you pretty much have to double your total aggregate bitrate. So if you have 8 megs or 9 megs aggregate bitrate, you pretty much want anywhere between 16 to 18 to 20 megabits of upstream bandwidth. And that just allows for spikes in network traffic. So content acquisition, which really just means cameras and stuff. This is a kind of a simplistic view of the gear that we... Oh, there's my light back. Thanks very much. This is a simplistic view of the gear that we had on the Channel 9 live stage. It's actually a little bit more complex than this, but this is how I've tried to simplify it, if you can call that diagram simple. The lovely little colourful people on the left are obviously my guests and anchors on stage. We actually had 8 separate camera inputs for this particular show, but normally we have 4. We use Sony BRC H700 robotic cameras, which sound really, really cool, and they kind of are. We bolt them to the truss, so they're actually off the ground and they're kind of part of the set themselves, and they hang kind of upside down, and they're all completely remotely controlled from a center console. So we have a video engineer on site who sits in front of a bank of monitors. He has a joystick, and he has a lot of little buttons that he can press to control all those cameras individually. I think we have up to 8 presets per camera as well. So one of the things we do before we start the cameras rolling in the morning is we load up as many presets as we think that we're going to need during the day. And they could be, you know, wide overhead shots, or they could be singles on individual guests on the stage. Camera one is usually overhead. Here at Mix, we have a lot of interesting guests on stage from the Windows Phone world, and they like to bring devices with them to show demos. We've found that the easiest solution for capturing a phone demo on something like Channel 9 Live is just a camera bolted to the ceiling, pointed down. So that's really why that's an overhead camera. The other piece of equipment on there, before I get to the TriCaster, is an Image Pro, which actually the screen cap guys are using one here, and I have one in my rack. This is basically the Swiss Army knife of scan converters. Screen capture is very difficult, especially when you're doing something Channel 9 Live that's very fast-paced. We have guests coming on and off every 30 minutes. We've never seen their laptop before. We literally have 30 seconds to get them set up before we're live on the air. So you really need something robust like an Image Pro that can just take any input signal you give to it, automatically acquire it, understand what it is, and then upscale or downscale to whatever output it is that you need. In this case, we're doing 720p out from our Image Pro. And then all of that plugs into the TriCaster, which is this device here in the bottom of the rack. Just kind of closing the lid there. So the TriCaster is made by a company called NewTek. They've just announced a brand new one at NAB, which now that I've plugged them in this session, they're going to send me one for free. No. And it's it's basically a Windows 7 64-bit machine in a 6U, or is it a 4U? In a 4U rack, server rack, it has 8 HD SDI inputs, which is kind of crazy, and it gives you 3 HD SDI program out. So we used up all 8 HD SDI inputs for a Channel 9 Live here at Mix, and we actually used all 3 out as well for all our various program outs, the redundancy to the on-site in Spinnaker, and then primary out to Vivix. We have a few monitors on stage. The bottom right monitor there with Twitter, that's how we go about our interaction and how we take questions from the audience. So we have Larry Larson from Channel 9, who sits in front of his laptop and has it connected to this kind of overhead camera, and that's how we display Twitter, which I'll talk to a little bit more. And the other interesting thing about the production of Channel 9 Live is we're actually pretty lean. We have basically 7 staff. I kind of serve as producer, which basically means that I just stress people out unnecessarily. We have Michael, who's in the back there, who is our director extraordinaire, who runs the TriCaster and gives his direction to our video engineer on what kind of shots that he wants. We have a video engineer that's sitting in front of the robotic control cameras, who's actually controlling those, bringing in presets and or changing camera angles on the fly. We have 2 audio folks. We have an A1 who runs the board and is responsible for the mixer, and then we have an A2 who's getting microphones on and off of people. And then we have a stage manager, and that's pretty much it. We really run 6 to 7 staff in order to put on Channel 9 Live, which I've talked to people that come from the world of television and live broadcast television, and they just said I was crazy, absolutely crazy, to try and do 6 hours of live TV with 7 people. Personally, I think it works really well, and I'd love to even reduce it further if possible. Not because I don't like any of the 7 people, but it's just I like minimalistic things, and I think kind of if you can simplify stuff, then the better. anyway, so oh look, there's Michael. So I'm going to talk about live switching and kind of how the TriCaster works for those of you that are intrigued. This is the only live switching unit I've ever used, so I actually don't have a lot of experience in this space. If you do have questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them for you. But my only experience is with 2 models of the New Tech TriCaster. So here's the back of it, and there's the 8 HD SDI inputs up top with digital audio, and then they have component input underneath that. Lots and lots of balanced XLR in, dual power supply for when it fails, which never has, and lots of other goodies. So you've pretty much got a lot of options with this thing. This is the controller board, which we only just got on Monday. I think it was only just announced very recently. And Michael had never seen it before. It arrived on Monday. We went live on Tuesday morning. And he had it all down pat by then. So that's how you can call up all your cameras and transitions and titles and overlays. And without the controller board, without the big TriCaster board up top, you need to use a mouse and keyboard. So I just put it there for comparison. And that's obviously very cumbersome when you have 8 cameras and titles that you're trying to switch backwards and forwards. This is what the interface looks like. This is just a photo. I tried to grab a screenshot from the TriCaster when we were live, but I was very nervous that I would ruin things. So this is kind of what we're looking at once we are live. You can see all the camera sources up on the top left there. There's seven running there. The 8th we plugged in a little bit later on. There are 2 DDRs, which are essentially pre-recorded footage. So we have some animations that we roll in and out before and after the show, and we also roll that in between segments. We have slates and titles, and then we can also bring in audio. And this is basically the interface that Michael sits in front of for about 7 hours a day. Cameras. So this is what our video engineer James sat in front of. There is a bank of Image Pros on the right, which I actually don't really know what they all did. But the important stuff there is kind of on the left, where he has the monitors for all the cameras and the joystick. These are the Sony BRC700s on the left. So you can see they actually are kind of cool looking. They're completely robotic. They have a full 360-degree motion, and then I think it's kind of a... I don't know, but they kind of go up and down in that direction. Is that pan or is that tilt? What's that one? What's this one? That's tilt? Okay, so they've got full tilt. And that's all controlled remotely via the joystick. And these are 1080i HD SDI out natively, which is kind of nice. We can just plug them straight into the TriCaster, and the TriCaster will scale the 1080i down into 720p. We actually just used a fixed camera up in the scaffolding for our overhead shot. Normally, we'll use one of the BRCs, but we decided to use a fixed camera this time. So they're the two cameras there. This is the controller board. It's actually pretty simple for the cameras. You can see, I think it supports up to 7, and it's got the little joystick thing, which is cool. I'm just showing you some pretty pictures here. This is the stage, or the staging that we use for Channel 9 Live. We've evolved the Channel 9 Live set quite a bit. The first Channel 9 Live broadcast we did was from PDC 09. And we built it out like The Tonight Show with, you know, Jay Leno or Conan O'Brien. We had a stage, we had a desk, we had a couch, we had quite a lot of audience seating, and then we had a raised platform, kind of like what I'm on now, for the tech tables at the very back. What was really interesting is it looked fantastic. I think it looked wonderful. What was very interesting is that we couldn't get people to sit down and kind of watch and be a part of the live audience. For some reason, this happened again at Mix 10. This happened again at Dev Connections, the Silverlight 4 launch, TechEd North America 2010. For some reason, attendees at technical conferences don't want to sit down in front of a live interactive talk show, which is kind of interesting. So we killed that. We got rid of the Jay Leno style desk, and we got rid of the audience seating. And so now we're in this kind of funny triangular angular setup where we have we kind of shoot into a corner. We have a big conference table that our guests sit around, and then we basically have a scaffolding truss that goes around the entire edge of the set, and that's what we bolt all our assets onto. So the cameras are bolted onto that, the monitors are bolted onto that, anything we can do to get it off the ground. And this is what we have found works really, really well for the Mix and PDC, for the most recent Mix and PDCs, because it still allows people to stand around and watch and see what we're doing. They can kind of be a part of the action if they want to. They can kind of sit behind us and kind of be a part of the audience. But there's no kind of formal audience seating. And for some reason, I can't tell you why, but for some reason, that's what works. So if you are thinking of doing this at, you know, your own company or one of your own shows, that's just kind of the experience that we have. This is just to show the positionings of the cameras. It's kind of a little bit hard to see, I apologize. But there's 5 cameras there on the truss itself. We had another camera on a tripod out in the foyer, and then we took a screen capture source, which was a 7th camera, and then I think we plugged in an 8th yesterday for some reason. So now I want to talk about participation, and this is really important because, again, the reason why we chose to go live is because we wanted to give our audience the ability to participate and be a part of this conversation. It's really the reason why Channel 9 Live works is because we don't have a script and we aren't kind of reading from pre-prepared lines. We really are genuinely relying on our viewers to send in questions in real time and feed off other questions that they see on Twitter. So another interesting point, just from a production perspective, is that there's really no magic behind how we get the Twitter questions to our guests. There's an analogy for the Russian pencil analogy. Does anyone know this? Where, like, Americans spent hundreds of thousands of dollars making a pen that can write upside down, and the Russians just use a pencil. Our Russian pencil, was that it? Sorry? It's not true. Sven has debunked the Russian pencil. I love that story, Sven. It really will? And you can't use pencils in space. Wow, so that's fantastic. Okay, so I'm not going to say it's our Russian pencil. I'm going to say it's our upside-down pen. But using the flawed Russian pencil analogy, we looked at a lot of teleprompter software. We looked at ways of incorporating the Twitter feed like directly into the TriCaster as a camera input. It proved very difficult. All that we did is we have Larry's laptop, which you can kind of see closest to us on the right. He is extending his monitor to a second monitor, which is bolted to the truss, looking at the guests. He's copying and pasting tweets into Word. That's our Russian pencil. So I apologize for destroying the magic. But yeah, there's really nothing complex about how we get Twitter up on the screen. Just a sample of some of the tweets that we get. I like to show these because it's a really interesting, very, very diverse group of people that are they're tweeting us and the kind of questions that they're asking. We can't obviously answer all questions for a number of reasons. Sometimes we get flooded. When Scott Guthrie comes on Channel 9 Live, we just can't keep up. We get 20, 30, 40 questions a minute, and there's just no way to actually sift through them all and get them up on the screen. So sometimes we just have too many and we get flooded. Also, sometimes bots pick up weird keywords and all of a sudden you'll see one person ask a question and then like 25 spam bots are retweeting the same tweet for really no apparent reason. And again, you know, you get lost in the noise. And also the other challenge too, and if you are a content producer and you're thinking about doing this for yourself or for your clients or for your company, is that obviously, you know, we can't ask every single question. Sometimes they're going to be asking about things that are unannounced. They're going to be asking about topics that we can't really discuss, or perhaps they're asking questions that don't really have an answer in the sense that, you know, maybe decisions haven't been made. But regardless, we do our very best to try and pick out all the tweets from the live stream and get them in front of our guests to address in some capacity. The other thing that we do is we use the Archivist. This is just one particular scenario that was built by, I think, Thomas Lewis and Carsten Jankelevitz. Is that how you say Carsten's last name? Anyone know? Sorry, Carsten, if I butchered your last name. Carsten and Thomas from the Channel 9 or Extended Channel 9 team built the Archivist. And basically, you create an account with the Archivist, you enter in keywords, and that's it. It just goes and creates an archive of all tweets that it finds with that keyword. And that's very, very important because we have this amazing conversation with our live viewers. We have, you know, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 tweets that are sent to us directly over the course of 2 days of Channel 9 Live. We want to have a record of that. We want to know who's talked to us and what have they asked. So it's very, very important that we capture that in some capacity. And the Archivist is the tool that we use. We get some really pretty graphs at the end of it, and it allows us to have this kind of permanent record, which is kind of cool. All right, live production and VOD timeline. VOD stands for video on demand. I've learned over the last few days that I use the term VOD perhaps incorrectly. I'll tell you how I use it in just a minute. But I want to walk you through what our production timeline looks like for a Channel 9 live show, and specifically here at Mix. So at Mix, we're actually sharing the same primary transport with the keynote. So the high-definition signal that's coming out of the keynote room here at Mix is actually on the same Vivix path that we use. We have an engineer backstage that does a fade or a switch between the keynote signal and Channel 9 Live when we begin. So that's why you're seeing the keynote in the same timeline. So at 8 a.m., we turn our encoders on. We verify we have signal from both Channel 9 Live and from the keynote. We make sure we have audio. We make sure everything's in sync. We do some tests, and we make sure that everything's okay. The show at the keynote then begins at 9 a.m. The very first thing we do is we add a marker to the timeline. And that's very important because the encoders have now been on for potentially up to 60 minutes. So there's actually 60 minutes worth of content already in the manifest. So by the time the keynote's finished, you can actually scrub back and watch 60 minutes or up to 60 minutes of something. We try and put a slate in there, or we try and put color bars in there to be very, very obvious that this is not the keynote, in case people kind of do get a little bit confused. But we put a marker in there, and that actually signifies start of show for the keynote. Keynote runs for 2 hours. At the point when the keynote finishes, we have the engineer backstage who does the transition, does the switch to Channel 9 Live, and we start programming. At about 11:15, 11:30, we had, I think, someone at MS Studios pull together an RC edit, which we're now calling video editor edit of the keynote so that we could make that on demand, just the keynote itself, and we publish that on the website. So we used RCE or video editor in order to make the keynote available on demand as a kind of as a discrete piece of video that was part of the overall timeline. Channel 9 Live then goes through till 5 p.m. At 5 p.m. when we've finished our programming, we stop the encoders, but we leave our publishing point open. And this is where it becomes... this is where the discussion begins. What we do is we leave our publishing point open for the duration of the amount of content that we've just produced. So, for example, 9 a.m. was beginning of the keynote, 5 p.m. was the end of Channel 9 Live. We now have 8 hours of content in a single manifest that's available for anybody to watch at any time and scrub backwards and forwards in. The thinking here is that at 4:59 p.m., before we shut off our encoders, someone might come to the website, realize that they're at the end of the day, and go, I want to go watch the keynote. And they grab the slider, and they scrub all the way back to the beginning of the day, and they start watching the keynote. And so that person may also think, this is really good stuff, I'm going to keep watching. So we leave our publishing point open for that full duration again of 8 hours time to allow that person that came at 4:59 to basically watch the entire DVR window before we kick them off. And then at midnight, we shut down the publishing point, which does unfortunately kick off anyone that is still in DVR mode. And then we transition those bits to VOD or video on demand, which is basically a more permanent location. And Alex, is it true that before we shut down the publishing point, the whole manifest just sits in virtual memory? Is that right? Or is it committed to disk? Okay, yeah. So at the point when you actually shut down the publishing point, that's when the manifest is being committed to disk. At that time, it's actually sitting there in virtual memory. So in this particular example, we have 8 hours, more like 9, of 720p smooth streaming video in virtual memory on an Origin server that we are delivering to potentially 10, 20, 40, 50,000 people at any one time. So that concept alone is actually kind of mind-boggling. And then when we shut down the publishing point, it's committed to disk. Oh, it's only the manifest? Oh, okay, cool. If Alex was just saying it's only the manifest that's in virtual memory. It's not the full video file. So that was my mistake. Apologies. Cool. So now content. Content comes first. The reason that I say that is you might be production ready. You might have all the equipment. You have all the right people. You know how everything goes together. You can produce this content. You're very confident with your ability to actually plug everything in and start live streaming. But without good content, obviously it's pointless. That might sound like a stupid thing to say, but we have been approached, the Channel 9 team have been approached many times internally at Microsoft by teams that say, hey, we want to do Channel 9 Live. It's awesome. We love Channel 9 Live. And we're like, that's great. What are you doing? And they either don't really have an idea or it's not very substantial. It's like, oh, we're announcing an update to a service pack. It's like, well, there's not really a lot of substance there. You know, it's a big undertaking to do a live streaming event, especially something that runs for multiple hours. So it's very, very important that although you might be technically ready and you're production ready, that you actually have the content. And the content is multiple things. First of all, you need experienced anchors. The anchor is what I refer to as, in this particular example, that's Charles there on the right, Charles Torrey from Channel 9. He's the anchor. He's the moderator. And then Doug Crockford there is the guest on the left. The moderator is incredibly important, or the anchor is incredibly important, because they may have to run that entire segment by themselves with no interaction. You always have to plan for nobody watching you and nobody sending in questions. Now, obviously, that doesn't really happen, but sometimes it does, for whatever reason. Sometimes Twitter is over capacity and people are asking you questions, but you can't receive them. So essentially, it's like nobody's watching. That's why you need very, very experienced anchors that can run a 30-minute conversation with just them and another guest. And that's actually quite difficult. You obviously need to have good guests, popular or interesting people that are well-known, internet celebrities, and by that I mean the Scott Hanselmans of the world, although I shouldn't have said that because his head's already massive. But then people like Doug Crockford, too, who are just very well-known in the industry by name. And you don't really have to do much to actually explain who Doug is or why people would want to go and watch them. The other thing, too, is that multiple guests is also a great formula. We've found that on Channel 9 Live, the more guests you have on stage at once, especially if they all have a common theme or a common passion, it's fantastic because they'll actually feed off each other and they'll create an interesting discussion that's pretty much independent of what's happening with the interactivity on the off chance there's nothing there. And then, obviously, what makes a good discussion is obviously topics that are controversial. You know, controversial topics obviously always lead to lots of questions. Complex topics are also very good as well in terms of perhaps it's a new announcement of a piece of technology that's very difficult to understand. So people want more information. They need it to be demystified and broken down. That's another great topic. And anything that's obviously new or popular. And, you know, it's kind of easy to identify stuff that's new and popular, like Kinect or new Windows Phone 7 announcements, etc. What doesn't work? Again, this should be obvious, but it's worth repeating. Scripting doesn't work. We have actually tried a few sessions with scripts and having somebody reading verbatim a written script. It just doesn't work. We get around that by having experienced presenters and experienced anchors who can make stuff up on the spot and don't need a script, which is good. Because scripting just doesn't work. I like to say marketing fluff. Marketing fluff is somebody that comes up and says the word excited four times in one sentence in reference to how they feel about their product, or someone who's really just not really giving any substantial. Marketing fluff is basically buzzwords for the sake of buzzwords. We've found that on Channel 9 Live that content doesn't work. And anything that's self-promoting or rah-rah, I don't know if rah-rah is in like pom-poms. Yes, is that a term? No, I'm getting blank stares. Anything that's kind of just self-promoting again for the sake of promotion just really doesn't work. So the bottom line is you need very experienced anchors that could talk the leg off an iron kettle. You need great guests, and you need topics that are going to promote discussion either with the guests themselves or with your audience. And if you actually can add those three things together, you'll have great content. This is difficult to read, I apologize. It's just a screen cap of the schedule that we had for Channel 9 Live for the past 2 days. And all I wanted to show there is that most of the sessions that we have on Channel 9 Live are multiple people. We have a few rock stars like Scott Guthrie, who obviously needs no additional panelists, Dina Karmovich, the CVP from Internet Explorer. But most of the discussions that we have here will feature more than one person. And again, we do that because if there is no or little interactivity with the audience, at least those people can actually talk to themselves and have a very interesting conversation regardless. Okay, measuring success. I'm going to race through the last few slides. So I've actually adjusted this order several times, and I think I'm happy with this. What is the number one success metric? Well, I think the number one success metric is actually your long tail. It's your post-live. So you've invested in creating all this amazing live content. That's fantastic. But what do you do with it once you've stopped going live? What do you do with the 6 hours of content that you just streamed live to the web, or the 2 hours of content, or the 30 minutes of content? You have to have a solution to publish that stuff on the web in a permanent space, in a permanent location, so that it can be discovered and it can be consumed and it's there forever. It's archived. So for me, the long tail is really one of the most important success metrics. We will be cutting up all of the Channel 9 Live sessions from the past 2 days. There were 16 in total. They're 30 minutes long. I'll be using Expression Encoder 4 when I get back to Redmond, and I'll be cutting them up and re-encoding them into fixed WMVs for the 30-minute segments. I'll be publishing them on Channel 9. Over the next 6 months, those 16 segments will probably get 500,000 views. Compare that to the 20, 30, 40,000 live views that we get here at the show, which is fantastic, but the long tail is where the real value is in this content you're creating. So don't forget the long tail. The next important metric, which probably should be number one, I've been changing them around, is really the stream quality. And the bottom line is, were you able to deliver your live streaming event to your audience, or were there issues? Were you able to deliver a smooth, consistent video signal with audio in sync that could be consumed without people getting annoyed with buffering or drop frames or stop streams, etc.? So that's obviously very, very important. We use two tools to monitor that. We use Audience Insight, which is it called Audience Insight? It is. Audience Insight, which is built by Alex's team. It used to be called, had another name. And then we use Conviva, which is another company that does real-time monitoring. And they provide us with a dashboard on top, is Conviva and Audience Insight below. And we use that to monitor buffering. Buffering basically means that we're not getting bits to the end users in time, and so they're having to buffer before they actually start playing again. And that results in obviously a poor experience. And if people can't watch your live stream, they're going to turn off. So it's important to monitor buffering and ensure that you don't have that. And then post-event viewership, the four metrics that we keep an eye on is, what was our total unique viewers? How many unique individuals came and watched the stream? What was our peak concurrent viewer count? At what point did we have our peak? That'll also tell us where our most popular session was. What's the average session length? Now, for Channel 9 Live, our segments are 30 minutes in length. So if I have a session length of 30 minutes or more, thumbs up. It means that people are coming to Channel 9 Live, they're staying for at least one segment before they go away. If it's anything under 30 minutes, for us, we see that as, you know, we have some work to do and need to think about how we produce that content. And then the geographic breakdown is very, very important. We also created this fake metric called tweets per minute, or TPM speed, which is basically how many tweets incoming are we able to get up on the board and have our guests actually address. We think it's two. We think it's two tweets per minute is a really good run rate for ensuring a really good steady flow of interactivity, both in terms of allowing our guests time to answer the questions that can come in, and also allowing a good number of viewers to actually get their questions answered. Here is just a zoom in of the Conviva audience dashboard. This is not on live data. I think I took this a few days ago when we were testing. But one of the really cool things about Conviva is you get this great map, which happens to be not served up by Bing, but let's not look at that. And it shows you literally a little pin for every single user that you have. I'm currently in country mode, so it's all being condensed into... Well, it mustn't be. Yeah, I am. Country mode, so it's currently condensed into individual countries. But you can go down to the individual user level, which is kind of cool. And it really just shows you who's watching and where are they. And that's very, very important. And then this is Conviva. This is the Audience Insight dashboard. This was not a final build. If you're wondering kind of why there's the funny kind of jagged lines in between. But again, this is showing us where obviously all our viewers are coming in. You can see obviously the curve as viewers are joining the stream as we kind of get, and we have a kind of a plateau there for several hours, a drop and then a spike. I actually don't know what that is. I need to go in and have a look. And then it kind of starts to tail off towards the end of the day. Avoiding fails. I'm almost at the end, I promise. Avoiding fails. You need to spend a lot of time thinking about this. And we spend a lot of time thinking about this. We also have had a lot of fails, which are kind of good because you get to do a post-mortem afterwards and work out, what went wrong. You need to do two things. Well, you need to do several things. First thing, plan to be extremely popular. If you think you're going to have 20,000 live viewers, plan for 200,000 live viewers. Now, obviously, there are budget concerns and things you need to think about there, but you need to plan to be extremely popular, because if you are extremely popular and you have more people trying to watch your stream than your CDN or however you're getting bits out to them can provide, it's going to crash, and you don't just lose the additional people, you lose everyone. So you need to plan to be extremely popular. You need to assume that everything will break. And that's in the acquisition phase. You need to assume that a light will die, that a camera will stop working, that a cable will be cut. You need to assume from the transmission perspective that we actually were at TechEd North America in New Orleans, and we were using IP transmission to primarily get our signal out of the building. And there was a road crew three blocks away with a concrete saw, and they accidentally cut through the fiber lines coming into the New Orleans Convention Center. And we found out because, just everything went dark in the building. And that was fun. That was fun to realize that there was no internet at all for the entire New Orleans Convention Center for about 3 hours. You need to plan for transmission to break. Encoding and obviously delivery, and delivery is kind of more at the CDN side. Real-time monitoring. So Audience Insight framework that was built by Alex and his team, and I've got a URL at the end to learn more about it, is very, very important. If you are using smooth streaming based on the Smurf, which we're not calling Smurf anymore, player framework, make sure you use the Audience Insight framework to get yourself this real-time monitoring, because you just need to know. You need to know how people are watching, what your buffering levels are, any kind of issues that you're seeing with HTTP errors. Record to disk. If you do lose your transmission, if you do lose encoding, try and have a local recording of the content you're producing, because that way you can take that disk and you can at least publish it on demand at a later date. You might have lost the ability to stream live, but you haven't lost the content. So that's also very important. And then don't forget, if you are using third-party services like Twitter, they can fail. And they do fail. Twitter gets over capacity all the time. And if you're relying on that entirely for your interactivity, then it can kind of suck when Twitter goes down and no one can actually send you a tweet. Additional tips and tricks from me. Screen capture is hard. Again, Image Pro, I'm not endorsed by them, but if they want to send me several, I'll gladly accept them. Thankfully, I don't work for the government. This is the Image Pro here, which is the kind of the image scaler. Screen capture is difficult. So you need to really think about that if you are going to be taking sources from laptops and PCs for demos. There are also human failure points. And human failure points are things like bathroom breaks. If you are going to be broadcasting live for 6 hours, you kind of need to think about that in advance. You also need to think about, when do people need to eat? How many 5-hour energy capsules do they need? How many times do they need a Clif bar to kind of boost up their protein intake? There are human failure points that you must think about. One of the downsides of being incredibly lean, which we are on Channel 9 Live with 7 people, is that if someone has to run off to the bathroom, one of us has to fill in. So that's definitely something to think about. And then Twitter tricksters. What I mean by that is technical people at these conferences, you're genuinely smart, and smart people are usually funny, and funny smart people usually try to trip people up. At the Silverlight 4 launch, we had somebody who was submitting some fantastic questions, and they were from the XAML Table of Experts. Does anyone want to spell that out for me? XAML, T-O-E? XAML, toe? No? Blank stares. Okay. Well, we had about 10 fantastic questions coming from the XAML Table of Experts, which we kept putting up on the screen. They were great questions before someone said, you do realize what that phonetically says. And so there you go. So you have to be aware of sneaky, smart, funny people that are trying to kind of trip you up. So what's next for Channel 9 Live? I think a lot of people would probably see what we do and think that we've kind of nailed it and we have our configuration locked down. And we're very happy with what we're doing. We think we get great results, but we definitely have more things that we want to do. We want to start broadcasting much more regularly. We want to reduce some of the complexity that we already have. I would like more redundant options and processes. We only have one on-site encoder, which means that we can't match the 6 smooth profiles that we're sending out if we do utilize our external encoding company with iStream Planet. We also would like to look at Twitter and the interactivity element and how we can build that more into the actual on-stage experience. Currently, when we read your question out, literally our anchor is just kind of reading it from a screen. You're not really involved in the broadcast. We'd love to find a way to be able to show your tweet up on a screen with maybe your avatar or your picture and really involve our audience more in the actual content of the day. So, almost at the end. Try this at home. Everyone should go out and give this stuff a go. So what do you need to do? First of all, I recommend you start small and start simple. Rent this gear. Pretty much everything here is available to rent. You might have to make a few phone calls to find out who has it. Finding the right crew is important. If you don't have the right people, then the gear is inconsequential. Don't forget your on-demand or the long tail. And as I mentioned before, just because you're production ready, just because you have the capability to go live, it doesn't mean anything unless you have the content. So content trumps production readiness. Find great anchors, find great guests, and again, you have to at least assume you have no participation when you go live. And that's with 1 minute left. Are there any questions? I'm happy to take questions. Yes? To do the Channel 9 Live component at Mix. So the question was, how much does it cost to put on Channel 9 Live at Mix? It's kind of hard to say. I'm not trying to skirt the question, but because we're part of the keynote infrastructure as well, I would say anywhere between $50,000 and maybe $100,000. But this is, for us as Microsoft, this is the top of the scale. We have full redundancy on pretty much everything we do. We have full transport redundancy, full encoding redundancy. We're running 2 CDNs, Akamai and Azure. So this is really the very, very top of the scale. My little box here, this actually sits in the Channel 9 studios in Redmond. And I can stream live with this kind of at scale by just basically plugging in some cameras and plugging in a few network cables. And this is really all that we really need. So this is kind of like the bare minimum. And really, because we own that gear, it's really just paying for CDN charges and maybe bringing in an IP line if we don't have the right upstream bandwidth where we're going. So, but for Mix, about 50 to 100, probably something to think about. Any more questions? Sorry.
How much does this
thing
cost?
Oh, yeah, good question. Okay, so again, I don't work for these companies, but I think the Image Pro is somewhere around about $3,000. The Spinnaker is somewhere about 25. Well, this is the older one, yeah. So the Smooth Streaming Spinnaker, somewhere around about 20K. And then the TriCaster, they started about 10K. This one, I think, was maybe 25 or 30. And we invested in this equipment because we're doing a lot of live streaming now. So, this was an experiment. The experiment worked. Now we're doing We're doing 4 major broadcasts like Mix a year, and we want to start doing this on a monthly basis, if not, you know, bi-weekly. So that's why we invested in this equipment. But you can rent it. So if you don't have the money to actually buy the stuff, go and rent it and just try it. Just see if it works for you. And if all else fails, as we like to say, we'll do it live. I don't know if you get the reference. Yeah, you do. Thank you very much.